I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is so mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guest today is Frederick Panayotis, and who is the chef de cuisine or cellar master of Vuillenard. Vuillenard is the oldest champagne producer that was founded in 1729. And you may wonder why Japanese has a champagne master as a guest, but champagne goes well with many different types of cuisines, including Japanese food. But it's not the only reason why Frederick is here. He has a deep understanding of Japanese culture, and he's fluent in Japanese, including the Osaka dialect. So today, we'll discuss how Frederick got into Japanese culture, how he became the cellar master of the world-famous Champagne House, how he paired Japanese food with champagne, how climate change is affecting champagne production, and much, much more. But before we start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We truly appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Frederick Panayotis. Hello, Frederick. Welcome to the show.
Bonjour. Hello.
Hey, so cool. You're calling from the Champagne region. That's very cool. So, to get to know you, where are you from, and what did you eat when you grew up?
So, I was born and raised in Reims, in Champagne, with a family partly in the vineyards. What did I eat? I ate my delicious mom's food, a lot of vegetables that we would that she would, you know, keep for the winter, you know, like in jars. So healthy, but very little fish, I have to say.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Your DNA is champagne. I mean, I didn't see you start drinking champagne early, but it's the whole nature. You're surrounded by that very culturally rich region. So, wow, that's amazing.
Correct. Yeah. This is my hometown, and and when I grew up, I didn't necessarily want it to be a winemaker. Although I used to harvest at my grandparents' place when I was a kid and when I was a teenager, but I love the ocean. So my idea was to get away from here. But eventually, I ended up finding a job in this region, and I fell in love with the product as well.
Right. So you had to see the world first and came back to where you're supposed to be. I think it's like a destiny. So, and then when we met at the Vuillenard dinner event that was hosted in New York, and my jaw dropped when you spoke to me in fluent Japanese. And it was the last thing I expected from the person engaged in the most French occupation, making champagne. So tell us about your relationship with Japan, and when and how did you get involved in Japan and Japanese culture?
Well, first, Akiko-san, I have to say I am not fluent in Japanese. I can do a little bit, but
ペラペラ ではありません. That's the modesty of Japanese.
But no, I started to be interested in Japan a long time ago. I initially wanted to raise fish, and part of I mean, a lot of experience could be gained going to Japan. So when I was studying in Paris, agronomy, I took a few months of Japanese, really, you know, fell in love with a language, but didn't go any further than that. Many years later, a long story made short, I went to Japan for work. At the time, I was not with Ruinart, but I was working with Veuve Clicquot. And my first trip to Japan was very memorable, maybe not in the best way, because I felt so lost. Although I had, you know, taken a little bit of Japanese before, I couldn't understand anything. So I got very frustrated. And I understood that if I wanted to come back and get a better experience, I had to learn the language. So upon returning back, I decided to get serious and took lessons, private lesson with a Japanese teacher here in Champaign for about 5 years. And then I made many trips because next month I'll be doing my 41st trip to Japan.
Wow.
And so little by little, I think I got to, you know to speak a little bit and but more importantly, understand the culture even more.
Well, what really interests me, I heard you studied biology and fisheries, right? So is that like a biological knowledge? I mean, knowledge in biology probably helps to make good champagne, I think, right?
It does. I think, you know, there's two elements about making wine. But they're not opposite. So one of them, and that's the way I see it, is a lot about science. And, you know, agronomy, the science of soils, science of, you know, biology and biochemistry. So you need physics, mathematics even, you know, you would be surprised. But all those technical fields help you to, I think, understand some of the things that are happening when you transform grapes into wine. Help you to improve yourself because you can plan some experiments and learn from them and try to become better every year. And the other part is more about creation, intuition, sensation, feelings. And you need both. I think you really need both to, especially for the champagne where blending is so important. I think it's the combination of those skills that make you, I think, a chef de cap.
Right. That's interesting. Well, sounds like you have to use all parts of your brain. I don't know if the left or right brain thinks is correct.
Absolutely. No. You do need left and right brain to do this job, I think. I mean, you could do it with, you know, only, I don't know, like one or the other. But I think it's much more powerful if you can use both.
Right. So I'm sure that not just Japan, but you have to travel throughout the world, right? So maybe you don't have to talk only about Japan, but what's the impression of traveling through the world? And what do you learn or get a takeaway and then reflect in, you know, such a very complicated process of champagne making?
Well, what I like about traveling is... It's time for me to reflect, and it's time for me also usually to get direct feedback from customers and consumers. And it in a way helps me to try to understand what the future of the taste could be. You know, if people are asking for this type of style of taste, you know, this and you see the tendency in food, I think it's one of the way to get a hint of what the future of our industry of the wine should be. And so I'm taking this. Another element is that Ruinart is not the most international champagne house. We sell about 50% outside of France, but yet we are in more than 80 countries, and in a way we have to speak to a lot of different cultures. So I'm trying to figure out with my work, like, how can we please, you know, German consumers and at the same time Japanese customers, and of course they are quite different, you know. And having said that, some countries are more inspiring than others, and I'm not saying this because because this is, you know, about Japan. But Japan has had a huge influence on me because there are some similarities in the approach I have about the taste of the Ruinart Champagne, about the style of the Ruinart Champagne, which is purity, precision, and what I call simplexity. You know, simplexity is, and that's so Japanese for me when you, I will take the example of sushi, you know, nigiri sushi looks like the most simple thing for many people. But if you dig, if you speak with the chef, the complexity of the rice, you know, making the rice the proper way, the seasoning, the cut of the fish, the origin of the fish, the size, you know, the thickness, the amount of wasabi and everything, everything. At the end, you realize that this nigiri that you could eat in one bite is so complex. But it looks, in a way, very simple. And I have the same feeling with Ruinart Champagne. It looks delicious. It's very easy to appreciate. But behind the scene, there's a work of precision. You know, you can't make it so quickly. You need the experience, you need the expertise, and you need amazing grapes.
Interesting. I have to use that simplexity term. It's awesome. And people say French cuisines mindset is addition versus Japanese reduction. But I think just like you described sushi is also combination, like layering, like blending champagne, right? So I can see why you'd say both have different similarities and differences at the same time. And at the end of the day, what you look for is the most purified version of the taste experience. So yeah, I totally agree.
Mm.
Okay, so do you have any favorite Japanese food? I mean, regardless of pairings or whatever, you just have any taste?
I have too many. I would say what I like about the Japanese cuisine is more the concept of izakaya, where it's so balanced. You know, I think for me, izakaya takes into account the seasonality, all the elements of purity, precision, and the balance. And I think this I don't get in many places around the world, you know, if not only in Japan, probably. So of course it would be easy to say, let's say, you know, I love sushi, I love sashimi, I love tempura. I even love, you know, takoyaki or, you know, more so like okonomiyaki, sometimes simple things. But what I really, remember from the most amazing experiences when the whole dinner experience where it's so harmonious, the setting also and the flow, and it's, well, you know, and this cannot be matched so easily. You know, you can't redo it so often.
Right. Yeah, interesting. So the concept of izakaya is kind of, it's still foreign places like even to New York, but basically it's not one specific cuisine like sushi or tempura. It's like it compiled the menu, wide variety of dishes, basically home cooking, I mean, comforting and healthy food at the same time. And you can order anything you want, vegetables to meat to rice to noodles. And then the service is good, kind of like your mom's house. And then the good energy. And of course, there's good sake. I'm sure that the izakaya they serve champagne too. So,
yeah, it does. Yeah, but if I have to say one, I wouldn't say one type of food, but one ingredient, I'm in crazy love with uni.
So, ooh.
Yeah. But you can find in France as well. Not as good as in Japan, of course, but decent uni here. And also in the US, obviously.
Right. So uni, seojin, I think it's universal, like in Italy or other places. But I think if you go to Hokkaido, for example, it's ridiculously different colored or size or so. Anyway, so we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll discuss how you can perfectly pair champagne with Japanese food. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. The knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table, so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats on Heritage Radio Network, HRN. I'm your host, Aki Katayama. My guest today is Frederick Panayotis, who is the chef de cave or cellar master of Ruinart. Ruinart is the oldest champagne producer and was founded in 1729. And Frederick has a deep understanding of Japanese culture and is fluent in Japanese. So, I still need to say you're very fluent and culturally very, very fluent too. So let's talk about what you do now. So how did you get into this amazing? You know, you told me that you went back to your hometown to get into the champagne industry, but you can't just decide and, you know, from with the background of biology, you're going to go into champagne industry and be successful, right? So what's the process? How did it happen?
I fell in love with an amazing wine one day. It was at Christmas at my home, and my uncle had brought one of the top Grand Cru from Burgundy called Richebourg from the 1976 vintage. And I, you know, this is many, many years ago, obviously, but I still remember the scene, the glasses, the taste of the wine, and it's my first wow wine. I was drinking a bit of wine before. I was 21. But this wine was, wow, you know, something amazing. And a few weeks later, with the school in Paris, when I was studying agronomy, I got a chance to go to Burgundy and Champagne for like 3 weeks and with our teacher about winemaking and viticulture. And we had some amazing experiences, and I felt in love not only with the products, not only with the wines, but with the people, because the people we met were so passionate, willing to share, opening amazing wines for us students, you know, with no money. We were not going to buy anything, but they were still very generous. And I thought, I want to be part of that. I want to be part of that industry. I want to be part of that, you know, world. And so I decided to specialize my studies into winemaking and viticulture. So I went to the south of France in a university called in Montpellier. And then I started to work in different places in the Northern Rhone. I went to California for 3 years, and I came back to Champagne because this is where I found the making, you know, the crafting was so interesting.
Right. Well, it sounds like you were hit by the passion and the values that people believe in of making great wines and champagne. So it makes sense, because you were able to absorb all the passion, the feelings of the people, maybe because you grew up in Champagne?
Well, it was in me, I think, you know, in a way, because of my background, my family, you know, doing the harvest every year in Champagne. I had two uncles who were also like making a little bit of wine. My dad liked Burgundy as well. So I was, in a way, I was in an environment with wine around me. And I also understood that I could, in winemaking, blend the scientific expertise or studies that I went through. You know, I was passionate about mathematics, biology, as I said, physics, chemistry, geology, plants, everything, and the tasting part, which is in a way very intimidating at the beginning. You know when I joined the school in Montpellier to learn about winemaking, my first experience with the smell was disastrous. The teacher had laid down 80 different natural aromas, you know, like mushrooms. There was some truffle, I remember. I never smelled truffle before, so I could not recognize it. I didn't know what it was tasting like. But like, you know, different kind of citrus fruits, different kind of orchard fruits, spices, different flowers. And I think I scored like, I don't know, 10 out of 80. I mean, I was, my nose was bad. But I took it as a challenge. And this teacher about, you know, the tasting teacher was really an amazing guy. And little by little, you know, being very attentive and very passionate about it, you know, I became a better taster. And again, this part is much more intuitive. You know, first you need to learn, but there's always this part of that is a bit personal. And you have to immerse yourself into it to, you know, to really understand it, I think.
Mm. Well, this is actually a very key question, I think, because you have to remember the vintage in the past, right? Because the champagne has to be always consistent year by year. So you have to have a good memory of the components of what's making that standard best created flavors and tastes. So how do you remember those flavors? It's always to me.
My answer is very simple. I don't know what you loved when you were at school, Akiko-san, but I'm sure you remember everything easily. You would get out of the class of, I don't know what it was, but it was easy because you loved it. Same with the wine, you know. You have to be in love. You have to be passionate. And then it's easy to remember. You know, I can describe wines I've tried 30 years ago and I remember them because I really enjoy the moment. And so those strong moments, they stay in your memory. So, and then you develop this memory for taste as well. It's something that can be really, you know, developed and work. But again, you have to put your passion and your heart into it.
Mm, okay. I'll keep it in mind. You're right. I remember whatever I like. I can have detailed memories of what I really love. So you're right. So I have to expand my experience. So tell us about Rinard, because it's such a special producer within the region of Champagne. So how do you call on the mindset or the style of Rinard Champagne?
Good point. If I want to describe the style, I often refer to it as a combination of aromatic freshness, and I would say something like texture, but like a silky texture. And those elements are very important to understand how we make the wine, what varieties we use, and why they please so many people. You know, Rinard was, okay, oldest champagne houses. There are many facts that makes Rinard quite remarkable. But one thing that was always struck me with the history is Rinard has often been a pioneer. And as such, often combining tradition and modernity. And that's something that we have in mind. We have the craftsmanship, we have the tradition, but all wines are a very modern expression of winemaking. And the style of the house is driven by the Chardonnay variety. So there are three main varieties in Champagne: Chardonnay, white variety, and then Pinot Noir and Meunier, two black varieties. You know, I mean, the skin is purple black, and then the juice is clear. But at Rinard, but that's quite recent. It's only after World War II we decided to use a lot of Chardonnay to bring freshness, lightness. A form of accessibility in our wines. And I have to thank the last owner of the house who was in charge. It was actually, yeah, of course, owning and in charge of Rinard from 1946 to 1963. And I will quote what he told me because I was very lucky to meet him before he passed away. You know, he was still coming to Rinard, his ex-office, and I was meeting him quite frequently. And one day I asked him, Mr. Muir, that was his name, Muir, why is the reason behind the use of Chardonnay at Rinard? And he told me something that makes me laugh today, which I find very true, but he told me, Frédéric, I want my champagne to be enjoyable from 9 a.m. in the morning until 9 a.m. the next morning, which was such a perfect answer because he was a visionaire. You know, he had the idea of using Chardonnay when Chardonnay back in the days was not so common, but to use it a lot to make lighter champagnes, easier to drink with a beautiful definition. And we've remained true to this style, and I've remained true to the style as well. For me, the fact that Rinard Champagne can be enjoyed in the morning, in the afternoon, late at night. That's something that I find very important. So I in order to do this, I like to say we like to capture the fruit. So there's many ways to make champagne, but we try to not change the fruit quality so much. And our champagnes are non-vintage, Ruinart Blanc de Blanc, Ruinart Rosé. They're very much fruit-driven. You know, champagne can be yeasty-driven or have a spice, you know, maybe flavors coming from a long time on the lees or from the use of oak. Ours is, it's very pure, you know. That's why sometimes I made this relationship with, or this comparison with Japanese food, because I find Japanese food to respect the ingredient a lot and to be probably the closest, probably cuisine when it comes to enhancing the pure quality of the ingredients.
Mm, right. I mean, not to forget about the origin of Ruinart. It was like other champagne houses started by a monk, and it's a natural product. They harvest it from their yards, and then there you go. It's a beautiful, natural product. So, like, appreciating every piece of the bounty from nature in Japanese cuisine, I think it makes sense that, you know, the expression of, especially Chardonnay, is known for being terroir. Driven. And I think someone who knows a lot about different kinds of soils and climate all over the world, you absorb and you are part of this whole champagne by yourself. So it's interesting that you said that. You succeeded the mindset from the previous owner, but you're totally living it. So yeah, that's interesting. And by the way, not because you're here, I love Ruinart because it's this kind of natural flow into your body and you don't have to think about it. It just comes in.
And, yeah, that's what I was trying to make. And you know, I always say it's like, if I make a comparison with music, it would be like the jazz from either Chet Baker or even more Stan Getz. Mm. You know, it flows, it's easy. You don't need to be a specialist to like it. But of course, if you are, I mean, you know, this guy was Stan Getz was a super famous saxophone player. But it pleases more crowd. So I understand that there are a lot of amazing producers in Champagne. And I'm good friends with a lot of them, and I love what they make. But each one has his style, and I think our style is, in a way, accessible to many people.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about the pairings that with Japanese food that you can totally convince people who's listening to the show. So some people know of being extremely versatile when it comes to food pairings, not with Japanese too, but what's the key point of pairing food with champagne, first of all, before we go into Japanese food pairings?
Well, I think champagne, generally speaking, is a delicate wine, you know, between the way it's made, between the varieties, between the high acidity typically that is a characteristic of champagne. So it pairs better with lighter food, more delicate food, you know, like heavy, super spicy, super heavy, super rich. It's better to go for something else, you know, like, and there are so many great wines or sake in the world that you can find other pairings. So then a few ingredients that are very hard to match with champagne, like everything that is, I would say, too green. Chocolate is very difficult. Anything, as I say, too spicy, too strong. Apart from that, champagne, you know, can pair a lot of elegant food because it has that effervescence. And I think effervescence creates sometimes a link between the solid and the liquid. And it tends to also, with the freshness, cut through some fatty ingredients. So champagne is very versatile. And also champagnes is made in different ways. You know, you have Blanc de Blanc, you have Rosé, you have Blanc de Noir, you have vintage, non-vintage. So there are a lot of different styles of champagnes as well. So when you put all of this together, the world is your oyster.
Right. It's interesting because the champagne is double fermented, right? The second in the bottle too. And I think that is gentle to your body and to your palate. So I think that's another layer of the flavors because it's fermentation twice. And that makes you I'm more prepared to eat and drink together. And that's the gentleness I always feel. Based on that, how do you pair Japanese food with champagne?
What should we start with? Which Japanese food should we start with? I have so many examples. So I can start with something that, you know, that is people are, I mean, probably most people listening to us are familiar with, tempura. I think tempura, but again, depending on the ingredient inside the tempura, but it has this crispy, light, the flavors are reminiscent of the, you know, like the breadcrumbs. That is very typical of champagne as well. I think tempura pairs so well with like blanc de blanc champagnes because of the lightness, the you know, in a way, elegance, and so that for me is like an amazing match. If you go,
right. So the blanc blanc basically is only Chardonnay, that fruitiness, cleanliness,
right.
Yeah, of the grapes. So that makes sense with tempura.
I will find another way to pair blanc de blanc as well. If I would go into fried food. And this is something we do here in Champagne, you know, when we have chicken. So like karaage, I think with Champagne it's amazing. Again, because of the crispiness and, it's a bit more, in a way, not as refined, but it goes with like, let's say a non-vintage Champagne with a blend of different varieties, you know. And same with tonkatsu. I think, you know, again, you might be surprised, but those dishes that are maybe not as, in a way, refined as other Japanese food, I think they can go so well with champagne, you know, because the champagne, in a way, enhances the experience, you know.
Right. You feel very luxurious after eating like the tonkatsu and karaage. Yeah, but it's amazing that, you know, both dishes use soy sauce and you don't really intuitively think soy sauce can go well with champagne. Right.
So because of the umami, you know, we have this, as you mentioned, we have this second fermentation and we have the contact of the yeast and something like there's a lot of amino acids. And I probably, you know, I'm not a specialist of the composition and the taste of it. But I think, yeah, there is definitely some like umami related taste in champagne, especially more like in vintage champagne. So yes, that also probably makes another bridge between champagne and Japanese food.
Right.
Now, probably the most common pairing that people think of when they come to Japanese food would be obviously either sushi or sashimi with champagne. But in that case, I'm typically a bit more, I try to be a bit more precise because, you know, if you take white fish or blue fish or tuna, for instance, the pairings are totally different. I don't think you can pair akami like you would pair sayori, like you would pair sakana. You know, suzuki, I was going to say, or tai. Because the texture is different, the taste is different. And so you have to be a bit more precise when it comes to the pairing with sushi. Because the sushi, there's such an array of flavor that they, in a way, deserve different kind of champagnes to make a perfect match.
Right. That's a great point because I think, from the beginning to the end of sushi omakase menu, it's almost like from white fish to meat, right?
Yeah.
And for example, I really enjoy akami tuna with the gamay, good Beaujolais gamay grape. Like the bloodiness of like an iron goes so well with each other versus like suzuki, like you said, I definitely prefer something like champagne. So that's interesting. I was going to say, you know, you said umami goes well with champagne. So maybe something like miso can be good.
Absolutely.
Wow. There's so much diversity with the pairing with champagne. And I found an article in your interview article. I mean, fridge, you said, in my fridge, you always find lots of Japanese condiments such as soy, ponzu, and mirin. So can you comment on ponzu and mirin too?
Because I make soba quite often or udon, you know. I don't make my own udon, but I buy them and then I because it's a quick fix and it's also very tasty. So yeah, so I make my own dashi typically. You know, I either buy katsuobushi or I even have the whole bonito, dry bonito with me. And this is again, I think the flavors, the ponzu as well is very beautiful because of the citrus fruit component in it. I also have like sudachi juice. I have kabosu juice. I grow my own myoga and I still have myoga right now.
Wow.
In my garden. So a lot of ingredients that can help me always, you know, to try to have the right, combination of flavors, for like a quick fix.
Mm. Oh, wow. Maybe you can write a book on how to pair champagne with Japanese food. I'm kind of half serious. So so how do you not to pair? Like anything you shouldn't pair with Japanese food with champagne?
Okay, I can give you a few examples. I know like in France, you love oysters. But I find like raw oysters or shackled oysters to be often too salty to pair with champagne. Mm. Like, I know this is a very, in a way, traditional pairing, but I don't like this pairing. I think the oysters always win. But you can do oyster tempura, and then it works because it's softer, you know. Mm. But the raw oysters, that's definitely something I would avoid. Something strong, maybe it's just me, but I'm not a big fan of natto. I find it too strong. So this I would probably not pair. There are some vegetables sometimes that are very, very green, like, you know, green in terms of bitter in Japan. And I find some of them being a bit difficult. It's not that bitterness is always bad. I have the example of ayu, where the bitterness, I think, that comes from the liver. And it's so good. I think ayu and champagne works so well. But some vegetables are too strong.
Mm. Right. But Japan has a lot of very strong vegetables too. So interesting. And well, it sounds like pot dishes, like a nabemono with dashi can be good. And I think this conversation really makes us realize, well, champagne can be very casually enjoyed. Not like for us.
Yeah, takoyaki and champagne. Come on, this is so good. Every time I go to Osaka, I need to have takoyaki, preferably quite late, with a bottle of Renard Blanc de Blanc. I think it's so good.
Oh, wow. So listeners, we're not familiar with takoyaki. Basically, takoyaki is wheat-based casual balls. And at the center, there's a very soft textured octopus. And the sauce is kind of rich. And I think that's the fattiness of the sauce, and the champagne goes well too. So it's just like a street food, the typical Osaka style street food, but then champagne in the glass. That's so cool. I have to try that. Right. So, there's so many variations, but as a producer of champagne, I heard climate change has become more obvious, even in the Champagne region. And I heard you have to conquer the challenges you're facing every year, which is getting more difficult. So maybe you can share the story about what you were working on.
Climate change for us is it's nothing new. You know, being in this industry for over 30 years, we've seen changes in Champagne where as early as, I would say, the mid-90s, we had years, at the time we didn't realize it was probably climate change, but we saw some New Balance in the grapes and so on. And then in the year, we had 2003, which was a big shock for all of us in Europe and including Champagne, where we had three heat waves, one of them being very deadly, taking the lives of so many people because, you know, temperatures were so high, especially at night. So to summarize something, so in 2003, we harvested in August, and it was probably the first time in the history of Champagne. When I was picking grapes when I was young, it was typically late September, in October also, so, you know, like a month, at least a month later. But since 2003, we've had six more harvests in August. So what used to be extremely rare is now becoming not quite the norm, but going through the norm. So we see the change associated with global warming and climate change, particularly here in Champagne. And so what it does, besides making the harvest, being in August or early September, it also changes the balance in the grapes. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, our one of the know-how of champagne is to be able to blend every year and make your non-vintage champagne, whether it's Blanc de Blanc or regular Brut or Rosé, taste nearly the same year after year. But with climate change, it's becoming more and more challenging. And so a few years ago, my boss challenged me about the style of the house. And he told me, Frédéric, how are you going to maintain the style with the climate change? You know, you're always talking about aromatic freshness, but do you think you can do it forever? And I have to say, it did something to me. And I was like, okay, let's try to process this and what could we do? So we decided to, in the warm years, select some wines, put them aside, and create a new blend from it. And so we created in 17 for the first time, but 18 is the true first cuvée of this wine called Blanc Singulier, which is really a proof in a way, like a champagne proof of what's happening in the vineyard. You know, it's a Blanc de Blanc, but it's richer, made from the ripest tanks with no dosage. And has quite a different style from the regular Blanc de Blanc. It's still very beautiful, still quite elegant, but there is more richness to it. It's not yet in Japan. It will be introduced next year, I think, in Japan. Very limited yet, but it's really a living proof, you know, like a testimony of climate change. So it's a champagne with a message as well. It's like we want to say, listen, and we're not the only one. Now, of course, everybody in Champagne is going through this as well. But we wanted to have a champagne with a message to the consumers, to our customers, say, listen, things are changing. So, you know, everybody needs to do, in a way, whether it's individually or with the company or with politics, but everybody needs to make things change, you know, like your impact on the planet needs to be lowered. So that's for us a way to show that the change is a reality. It's also a way to show that we can still make champagne. You know, okay, the climate is getting warmer, but it doesn't mean that we're not going to make champagne at least for another 50 years, I think. Maybe we'll see in the future. Maybe in the long future, we will make more still wines because the climate will be more prone to make still wines. But it's really quite important for people to understand, for consumers to understand that in all vineyards in the world, things are changing.
Right. Well, that really indicates that the Renault's new kind of style of champagne is the indication that Renault is always a pioneering and
exactly.
Flexibly adjusting to what's happening. Because we can't say there's nothing happening. It's true. And you said no dosage means that the grapes are so ripe that you don't have to add sugar, even in the northern part of France. So I think it's, and I got to taste that new style of champagne as well, and it was amazing. So why not? I think change is hard. People tend to look back and it used to be good, but it's not the case because your champagne, new style of champagne is amazing. So maybe it's not always bad to have this kind of change. So yeah, so I can't wait to see what's going to happen, you know, over the course of the next 10 years, 20 years, how we know our product is going to inspire other champagne producers or anybody in this who's facing this climate change. So, so what are your plans and dreams?
My plans is to what are my plans? My current plans now is to work on the harvest we just put in the tanks and create you know, the Renard blends this year. So that's the plan, the immediate plan. And my plan is to, I don't know in how many years, but to give the key of the cellar to my successor. You know, I'm getting in the age where I need to think about retirement, about my next life, and of course the transition is very important because this the position of chef de cave is a position that brings stability to the house in terms of, you know, the style is so important. So I will need to spend some time with the person who is going to take my position and make sure that the transition is very smooth. So that's in, I would say, the plan for the next few years. Dreams is probably for after. Dreams, if I talk personal dream, is probably to find a place where I can enjoy my time. And one of my favorite activities is free diving. And actually, I'm thinking of going to Okinawa very soon to see if it could be a possible place where I could spend some, you know, time in the long future.
Right. I heard Okinawa is the dream place for divers. So hopefully, and good food, and you can bring
and
a
good
lot of
food
champagne.
And yeah, so that could be a dream. I don't know. I will see. You know, there's. I'm not so much of a dreamer because I'm probably too busy with things. But maybe I should take more time to, you know, to think about it. But yeah, I do have maybe, you know, dreams of doing different things in the future. You know, maybe making a little bit of my own wine or using my expertise for different things and helping people. So yeah, I will see. You know, there will there's. But right now, I'm very very busy with work. So that's and I'm happy with it.
I think you're living in your dreams. So that's
well,
why you
in
don't...
a way. Yeah, I'm very, yeah, no, but you absolutely touching a point, you know, like I don't feel I work, you know, like I'm happy to go to wake up every day and go to work because I don't feel like I work, you know, it's my passion. So yeah, I am living a dream. That's for sure.
Right. That's going back to one of your students, when you visited the wineries and the champagne houses, these are the passions and dreams that you succeeded from them, right? So that's amazing. So, all right, so keep me posted and maybe you can come back and then discuss more. Maybe Okinawan food pairings with champagne or your own
wine.
Oh,
yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait to try some of the Okinawa specialties. So.
Right. Okay, so where can we find your updates online and on social media?
We're pretty active on Instagram. There we have two accounts. One of them is more about the house. It's just Ruinard. And one of them is with my team. It's called Ruinard Winemakers, where it's more geeky. We tell about, you know, what's going on in the cellars, some new products, what we are trying to do in our vineyards with biodiversity. Something I forgot to mention is with climate change, we see the biodiversity being, you know, affected. So we are trying very hard to reestablish more biodiversity in our vineyards by planting hedges, trees, doing things with the soil and everything. So this is, if you're a wine geek, and even not if you're a wine geek, there's some very cool information there. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, those would be our two active. We're on Facebook as well as Ruinard. And of course, on our website, if you want to come to Champagne and visit Ruinard, I think you go through the website and can check the availabilities to visit our magnificent cellars.
I saw pictures and it looks amazing. So, yeah.
They're unique. They are really unique. You go nearly 40 meters underground. It's such a silent world with thousands and thousands of bottles patiently aging. There is a bit of art as well because the other part of Ruinard is it's including in the name, art. We do a lot of things with contemporary art. You know, we're like, let's say, in New York with Frieze, with Los Angeles as well, but also in France, also in Japan with Kyotography. So we do have that passion for art. We've had it for a long time. And so, yeah, this is, it's a very cool, very beautiful cellars to visit with a bit of art as well.
Great. All right. So, well, thank you so much for joining us today, Rick. And hopefully I'll see you here again in New York, or I'll see you on your maybe 50th trip to Japan or something like that in the near future.
I hope so.
Right. Okay, so listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for short topics or guests, please contact us at Japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or at kikotema.com. Japanese is a weekly program and is always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Armin Spencer. Thanks for listening. I will see you next week. Japanese is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.